Come on, come on.
And the ghettos play long nights on a hot summer's block where you sip your brew and never touch your glass. This is for eyes that cry like yours and learn to smile again. Rise above the pain. This is for
Spitfire Bees Alive, the women of color in Montreal. We come together to say no to the silencing of our voices.
Edition of Spitfire Radio, Women of Color Radio, every last Wednesday of the month on CKUT 90.3 FM. Dr. Kimberly Crenshaw is a pioneer in the legal field. Dr. Crenshaw has been a professor at the UCLA Law Faculty for over 20 years. She's a key figure in the critical race studies movement, producing seminal scholarship, and has actively worked to make the law and the legal profession more accessible to people, and especially women of color. In this homage to Kimberly Crenshaw, Alyssa discusses the barriers that women of color face in accessing legal careers and the importance of Kimberly Crenshaw's work. 2 weeks ago, McLean's published an article entitled Too Asian. The article begins by quoting a high school student saying that she would not choose the University of Toronto because it is essentially too Asian and that the killjoy, antisocial, and competitive attitudes of Asian students have made certain universities a less desirable place to go. The public response to this article has been considerable. In Toronto, Sabrina spoke with Florence Lee, the project coordinator of the Chinese Canadian National Council, and also one of the main organizers behind Two Asian Talkback, a group formed in response to this article. Lastly, we have the second installment of our interview with Dr. Tara Atluri, Professor of Women's Studies at York University. Professor Atluri researches race and comedy. She's also the one behind the Where is Omar? Street art installations in Toronto that seek to raise awareness about the Omar Khadr case. Professor Atluri talked to us about this project as well as identity politics and social change. So stay tuned, all this coming up. You're listening to Joy by Bonnie Pink on Spitfire Radio, CKUT 90.3 FM. Up next, we have an interview with Tara Atluri on race, comedy, and social change.
Material body, right? You can't escape the fact that, like, you can be a professor at Duke University and be associated with a bathroom attendant or someone on welfare, right? That you will always have a certain kind of body that is read in a certain kind of way.
So that night when you posed as a bathroom attendant, did you reveal yourself in the end? What were the reactions? How did it also make you feel to be embodying that role?
It was funny in the sense that, like, I don't know, like, it was funny because, like, so many people, like, I thought everyone would get it right away because it was this academic event where people were, like, it was like an art show and, like, somebody's birthday, I don't know, but it was an art show, really, and I thought people would get it right away, but there were people who actually mistook me as a bathroom attendant, and there were some awkward moments, like, somebody I know in academia, his partner, actually thought that I was the bathroom attendant, and, like, I think it was just really interesting to see how much things like dress and language really matter. Like, that was what was interesting about it, is that it's not just about race, right? Like, when you talk about race, like, if I had been wearing the clothes I'm wearing now, and I normally wear, and had this accent, fine. But the minute you, like, it's an association with the foreign, with not being a citizen, and I think that, so, and it's tied to ideas of secularism, and, like, as soon as you are associated with a religious kind of immigrant subject, how quickly, and through dress, through accent, how quickly people just assume that you are, like, completely of a different species than them. And then when I changed it to my clothes, I feel like there was also this, I thought, like, they were so, it's also guilt, right? The people afterwards, like, it wasn't like they were like, oh my god, like, there were people who believed I was the attendant, who seemed angry and guilty afterwards that it was like they had been duped into this. I don't know. There were some interesting moments. People also believe in this idea of authenticity. So if I was to walk around wearing a sari and speaking in an Indian accent, the idea that I could stop doing that really troubles people, right? Because they have an idea then that, no, if, you know, the identities are fixed, and that you're somehow, and which is one of the reasons I did my thesis on Ali G and Borat, is this idea that, like, there's something, like, about, like, you know, that you're pulling one over on people if you can go in and out of certain speech acts and in and out of certain voices, as if there should be an authentic subject, right, behind these performances. That was really interesting.
And you were in a room full of academics, people who pride themselves on being super informed and having things under control and understanding the world as it is, right? Your colleagues.
I know.
This is the world you existed. Is academia somewhere you wish to stay?
Like to teach if I could. I mean, yeah, I would always like to teach. I think I'll always like to teach and read and write in that sense, that it'll always be part of my life. I like it in the sense that I think when you have these experiences, like the bathroom attending experience I had in London, it was a good way of making sense of that experience, right? Because I think, like, as people of color and as people who are, you know, second generation immigrants, or people who, you know, might have families and relationships that cross lines of class, that cross lines of language, that cross lines of citizenship. It's a way, I think, of making sense of those experiences. Like, that's what this piece was, and I wrote about it. So I think in that way, I like academia in that sense. And I like teaching to a large degree.
That's great. You have, like, great contributions.
I hope so. My most recent thing that we're working on right now is my friend Ansel Gosein, who's also a professor, and I have a sort of arts collective that we've started, or I don't know, we're working together, and we're going to put on an art show called Brown Male. We're putting a proposal in to show in Toronto and hopefully in Montreal as well. And the show will deal with representations of brown masculinity since 9/11. So it's inspired by the work of Thelma Golden, who was a curator in New York, who had a show called Black Male at the Whitney Museum that was really influential. And one of the reasons Golden's piece, like her show, was really great was that it refused to cleanse black masculinity of all of its kind of variant, like, many representations. So she refused to kind of show positive representations of black masculinity only, and she had Mapplethorpe's really famous photos, which are, like, these erotic photos of black men that are really controversial. And so Brown Male will take from that, and will show kind of all of the variant representations of brown masculinity since then. We have to stress, and we stress in the call, that it's not just about representations of brown masculinity, it's also about, I mean, since 9/11, it's also about, you know, all of the variant representations of brown masculinity from colonial history to now, from Gandhi to, you know, Apu from The Simpsons to, you know, all of these representations of brown men. And even what it means to be brown men. Like, so we have a Latino artist who submitted, we have Arab artists who submitted, we have South Asian artists. So even the idea of brown itself and how it's come into being as this kind of category that means everything and nothing all at once.
Right. Interesting how to, like, subjectivity really gets turned on its head.
Yeah.
And it's really created.
Yeah, and even the ideas of, like, South Asian, I mean, you know, in England, like, to be Asian means to be, like, brown.
Yeah.
Whereas here, it's, like, to be Asian means East Asian, or means, like, you know.
The labels and the monikers, things really get destabilized,
yeah.
For
so,
sure.
But we're interested in the ways in which art can come to represent that, and all the contradictions, and the ironies as well. I think that's one of the things in the art projects. Like, Paper Crane's second project it dealt with the case of migrants from Sri Lanka, Tamil migrants who came. Just under 500 migrants from Sri Lanka came to Canada, to Vancouver specifically, and tried to seek asylum. They were fleeing a civil war in Sri Lanka that's been going on for hundreds of years. It's claimed, like, countless deaths. The BBC reported that, I mean, over 60,000 to 70,000 people have been killed in the civil war in Sri Lanka, and many of them, you know, from the Tamil minority. And so just under 500 people came to Canada seeking asylum, and they've been detained, and they're now talking about what to do. And there was, what happened also was there was just a litany of xenophobic hate speech that came out, that people were saying awful things. And so we launched another art project called Vote People for Prime Minister, because there was a large discourse, and I I researched this idea of calling people this, like, yeah, that from like, the Vietnamese migrants came fleeing a war to Canada, and they were the original people who were referred to as this, but
right.
they didn't come in a boat, they came in planes, but they're called boat people, right? And so this idea of calling people this, like, you know, the Tamil boat people, I found it really interesting. The collective wrote these words, boat people for prime minister, on every single paper boat we made, and we made hundreds of paper boats. And then we put them outside a monument outside Old City Hall, and it says, for our glorious dead. And so, and it's a monument, you know, in tribute to people who died in a war, you know, Canadian soldiers who died in a war. So we put all these paper boats outside the monument that said this, boat people for prime minister. And it was about, on the one hand, like, just the irony, like, the term. Like, if I say to you, boat people for prime minister, it sounds ridiculous. But it's playing with the notion of, like, the fact is that within these liberal secular cultures, if you are already constructed as something like boat people, you're never going to be prime minister, right? Like, or it's really unlikely, because you've already been constructed as being less than or other than the ideal of the human, you know, liberal subject. In the same way that Omar Khadr is not a citizen. Putting it outside that monument that was a war memorial for Canadian soldiers is also about commenting on the fact that there are other wars in the world besides World War II. Right? There are other wars in the world besides the ones that Canada fought in.
And they're called different things.
Yeah, and if people are not aware of global history, or they're not cognizant of these global conflicts, when people come here, I feel like they're completely oblivious to the fact that these people are fleeing persecution and death. That this is a civil war that's been going on for, you know, a very long time.
Yeah.
And that it's not over, right? That these people, like, Sri Lanka has just passed, you know, new legislation that will give the Prime Minister more powers, and he'll be able to stay in office for a longer time. And so it's, I mean, it's not a safe situation. This is not new. It's been going on for, you know, hundreds of years. So I think that was also what the art project was about.
A lot of your work is inherently activist-oriented, in that it's raising awareness, it's educating, you know, everything's kind of coming together. What would you say is your main inspiration for any of the work you do?
I guess just politics. I feel like everything is political. And I think that politics, but also I feel like everything is political, and yet these days, in some ways, nothing is political. Like, Zizek. I really like the work of Slavoj Zizek. And everyone knows this about me. I'm one of Zizek's biggest fans, but I really... And Zizek says we live in an era of post-political biopolitics. And it's a really, like, theoretical term, but I think he lives... Look, if you break it down, firstly, the idea of a post-political era, meaning that politics is dead, right? We have now, like, a lot of NGOs that administer to communities, that deliver social services to communities. The idea of, like, a grand narrative of politics. So many times, like, on the left, people can tell you what they hate. They could tell you, like, I'm against racism, I'm against this, I'm against that, but what are we for? You know, what about politics? You know, the amount of people who don't vote. One of the reasons I thought it was really funny to write my, like, thesis on Ali G, my PhD, was that it was mocking also, like, the ways in which, like, youth culture is conceived of today as being completely apolitical. But I don't think you can blame young people. It's like we are living in an era where you are discouraged from being political. And so he's talking about this era of post-political politics, but also coupled with an era of biopolitics. And what that means is that at the same time you have, like, all of these, like, NGOs that are administering life, and you have, like, an era in which politics is dead, you also have the construction of these, of what Agamben would call the homo sacer, right? Like, you have an era of complete biopolitics in the sense that, like, you have these figures like Omar Khadr, or, like, you have the figure of the Tamil migrant, who are stripped of all political agency and all political rights. So these two things are happening at once, and not coincidentally together. Right? That you have a time where people don't care about politics, where you're just told to shop and enjoy life, and you have rights, and you're free. At the same time, you have people like Khadr, and you have people like, you know, Tamils in Sri Lanka, who have no right. You don't even have a basic right to life.
Right. So where else, in your perspective, in your opinion, where's the realm of influence? What's our next hope? Is there hope?
Yeah, I think the hope is a return to politics proper. Like, I think people need to have a greater political vision of the world, right? I think that there needs to be a return. And I don't, I mean, I'm really, I have really mixed feelings about identity politics. Mm. Coming from India most recently, I sometimes just think, like, what is it that we're complaining about? I feel like there's a lot of second generation migration narrative, which is repeated over and over again. Poor me, and like, I'm caught between worlds. And I think at the same time, like, I really do believe there needs to be a return to a politics of, like, an understanding of class. To, like, a communist politics, like, to actually having a greater vision of politics, like, what do you want, not only for yourself, and, like, you want to be, like, feel good about yourself as a woman of color, a person of color, but what do you want for the world, a larger vision? And I also think the way we practice politics, like, it needs to just expand and be more imaginative. That's one of the reasons I always was drawn to art, is, like, I mean, I've been doing, like, sort of student-based and that kind of activism, or been, you know, around these kind of communities for years, and it's like, I'm sick of the same old protest slogan. I don't want to rhyme immigration with deportation anymore. It doesn't even really rhyme, right? Like, I want something new. Like, I don't know. It's like, and also just, like, more creative, like, ways to engage with these ideals. Like, and more complicated ways to engage with them, too, right? So even just the Where's Omar thing, like, it's kind of funny, and it just, it's an engagement, like, just, that I don't know, it doesn't, I feel like it's not preaching to the public, but it's also not, like, I don't know, like, pacifying them either.
In your work, you've also really created space for this kind of criticism in your work. Right? Like, was it difficult for you to tap into that public space or to find opportunities to do the work you do?
I think one of the amazing things about street art, and one of the reasons I really like it, and I think we were talking about this earlier, where it's like, it seems bizarre to me that you would go, if you're going to have a protest, and ask the police where you can protest. And those same police you asked are going to come beat you up. It's weird, and it's the same with things like around art, or a lot of things that happen within, like, the West these days, or within a lot of places these days, where you are asking the same people permission to do things. It's like the entire NGO culture. You're getting funding from the same governments that will arrest you and deport you, right? Like, it's bizarre. Like, so I think one of the great things about doing street art is we don't ask permission, right? You just take over public space because it's your space.
Amen to that. I have one last question, only because it came up before, and I think your analysis is quite interesting. Would you consider yourself a feminist?
Yes.
What are your views on feminism?
Yes, I do consider myself a feminist. Yes, I do. I do in the same way that I would consider myself a person of color and anything like that around identity politics, because it's what Spivak calls a form of strategic essentialism, right? That I don't think, I mean, we are still at a time, like, I always come back to, like, things like the Montreal Massacre, right? I mean, there are still people who think like that, right? It's like, we are not in a post-feminist age where the idea of just, like, straight-up sexism still exists. I've seen it in academia, right? Like, working in a women's studies department, you will meet students and faculty who tell you that they don't know why women's studies needs to exist. You know, at the same time that you will meet, like, the amount of sexual violence that women experience on university campuses, sexual harassment, assault, and the university seems to just turn a blind eye to it. They would rather put their money into making, like, stadiums for the Pan American Games, like York University will do. Like, they would put more money into that than sexual assault safety, right? So that, in that way, I would call myself a feminist. But I also think that, still, the North American middle-class feminist movement does not speak to all women. It comes out of a missionary and colonial history that is always kind of either ignored or, you know, actively oppressed or been condescending to women of color and to, like, certain immigrant women. Like, you still have, like, people saying they're feminist because they want to rip burqas off of, like, Arab and Muslim women. That's not feminism, right? So I think I am a feminist, but I'm deeply critical of the feminist movement. In the same way, I'm a Marxist and I'm a communist, but I'm deeply critical of, like, sort of, you know, the mainstream Marxist and communist movement, which tends to be, like, a lot of old white guys, like, hawking the old, like, the international socialist. On that note.
That's amazing. All right. Thank you so much, Professor Dr.
Tara
Cleary.
Dr. T.
Dr. T.
Thanks, Sabrina.
No worries. You can check out Tara's work. Do you have a website or any shout outs?
You can check out Paper Cranes at We Are Paper Cranes. We have a blog space. You could also email wearepapercranes@gmail.com. Please don't quote me on anything I said, because I'll change my mind tomorrow.
Thank you, Dr. T.
His skirt, he called me a flirt, called him a celibate. Loved him so bad that it hurt, pinched a little bit. On the road now, soul to soul now. Slimmer cookouts with the fam and the whole ounce. Got that whoa, bounce, touch your toe, pounce. Baby, how you blow me a kiss with no sound? J.A., got that real live shit. I be cooling out to that peace vibe. Hit telephone 11 on his dope line. Tip dollar a dick to call my love. T.O., got that real live shit. I be cooling out to that peace vibe. Hit telephone 11 on his dope line. Tip dollar a dick to call my love, hello, hello. I said mushy, mushy baby, said I'm back in the morning. His charm shines through my window. Secondhand pencil, got that pre-roll. Run your instrumentals, now we back on the road. Even though all the static is thick, I hail you up quick, yo. Let you know I'm rolling at six. Movements, believe how they tick, just to see what get. Back on a jet plane, hours away. When he snuck glass panes, I clean your grass stains. Sold out with water, now he spent his last change in ice cream. Calls me his ice queen. Love will find a way, hurry, hustle, get dicey. Looking nice, keep it easy on the motion. Get to know me twice, rock steady meditation. Starry night sky, far east light shine. Malaysian lifetimes, black Asians on my mind. Dark beats and rhymes, Jamaica's on my mind. Heartbeats and lines, yo, you're always on my mind. So bro, I'm the DL for the moment we grow.
What?
Loving cell phones, ringtones on the go. Sing, sing, got that real live shit. I be cooling out to that golden tribe. Hit telephone 11 on his dope line. Tip dollar a date to call my love. Mount real, got that real live shit. Sauce cooling out on that peace vibe. Hit telephone 11 on his dope line. Tip dollar a date to call my love,
it's
my
telephone love.
Your instrumental, it plays over and over again. I'm never sick of it. Things got me tripping these days. I'm more than minimum wage. Two words on the page and take a pic of it. I'm on the road to get paid, then get so lonely it's great. Forever only a day before establishment. I walk alone, but if fate would maybe open a way, I make my peace with the sage, no middle management. I think we'll make it okay. I'm always late, but I pray you'll maybe wait on my case. Don't mind my arrogance. I got a lot on my plate, and when our futures are great, just a moment create before we vanish in space to darkness. I'm about to spark this love. Stay a few conversations with truth in a silent way when the city turned blue. Winter, spring, fall, last summer with you. BC, got that real live shit. I'll be cooling out to that peace vibe. Hit telephone 11 on this dope line. Tip dollar a date to call my love.
You're listening to Spitfire Radio, Women of Color Radio, every last Wednesday of the month on CKUT 90.3 FM. This is Meja One with Telephone Love off of the album Pull Out. Up next, we have an interview with Florence Lee, an organizer of Two Asian Talkback, a group created in response to the McLean's article called Two Asian.
Respect to the Southeast stand-up, triangle movements, Dago, Cali slang, rhyme side, international. Let's crack a lacking cuz, break out the purple swisher ride. Toronto, the gift and the curse, the worst and the first. My heart forever, and one academy, my friends and enemies. Big up the VK Moses legacy, breakbeat assassins family. Yo, Nicolay, thanks for blessing the beat. Salutations to the Flint Majesty, from Asia One, one love. I'm out.
Article states, many white students simply believe that competing with Asians, both Asian Canadians and international students, requires a sacrifice of time and freedom they're not willing to make. They complain that they can't compete for spots in the best schools and can't party as hard as they'd like. Too bad for them, most will say.
Asian kids, meanwhile, say they are resented for taking the spots of white kids.
So, I'm here with Florence Lee, the project coordinator for the Chinese-Canadian National Council of Toronto Chapter, and she is one of the main organizers behind Two Asian Talkback, a group that was made in response to the Maclean's article.
Again from Maclean's, they say, white students, by contrast, are more likely to choose universities and build their school lives around social interaction, athletics, and self-actualization, and yes, alcohol. When the two styles collide, the result is separation rather than integration.
Journalists have a really... Well, the one power that they have is the power to include or omit information, or omit certain people, and that's exactly what they've done. Of course they've interviewed people who support that question that they're asking, because this is the conversation that they want to create, right? Mm-hmm.
The article does quote, and I wrote this quote down because it stood out to me so much as this kind of multi-culti, it's a quote from the provost of U of T, and she calls Canada the Rainbow Nation, where she says, diversity has enriched these schools. So how do you respond to a statement like that that's being cited in this piece?
I think the administrators know what a cash cow international students are, and so for them to pretty much silence those voices and say, you know, we have people from all over the world and we all live harmoniously, like that's the kind of message that they want to send, but there are students who aren't happy, there are students who don't feel welcome, and there's no space and no support for those students. And by saying that, that's just basically doing what Maclean's is doing, just silencing.
How does representation of Asians in student governments or representations of Asians in position of power at all affect this phenomenon?
I mean, I think when you just look at the real world, it's apparent that there aren't that many Asians in power, but it's really indicative of the fact that you can study your butt off in school, you can get 4.0 GPA, you can get a great job, but once you get out there, there is that Asian, the bamboo ceiling, I think that's what they call it. You know, so this idea of meritocracy, that this
article... What's the bamboo ceiling?
Basically how Asians can work their way, can be a really good employee, but you reach a certain point where you can't go up because maybe they see you as... less authoritative, maybe not valued as much in terms of a managerial role.
Mm-hmm. Do you think this phenomenon or this kind of observation that Maclean's is making is unique to Canada?
I don't think it's unique to Canada. It's something that happens pretty much all over the world where there are minority groups, and I guess you kind of have to have a scapegoat, and people do feel threatened. And the way that they're pitting white students against Asian students, it's just, they're basically perpetuating that anti-Asian sentiment, and that kind of racism is all over the world. It's not just in Canada. And obviously, this isn't the first time that we've heard of this, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the way that it keeps coming back up is just, we're never going to be seen as Canadian, or we're always perpetually foreign.
What kind of harm or what effect does this have on the Asian student?
I think it makes the Asian student much more aware that they are Asian.
Mm.
And because Asian is equated with you don't belong here and you are not white. And that's something that is apparent to I've been aware of this for many years, but for some people, when you get to university and kind of start noticing these differences, and it does affect the way that professors might treat you, how your classmates might see you, then you become self-conscious of how you're represented. And this Maclean's article is basically telling you this is who you are. And so it's as if you have something to prove now. You have to go there and be like, I'm here because I worked my butt off and I deserve to be here. But there are people thinking that, you know, that space is rightfully theirs and that we're taking something from them.
I think space is a very poignant issue to bring up, and
how space relates to systemic power and institutional racism or institutional discrimination. How do these viewpoints, as latent, as nuanced, as, you know, supported by facts as they are, how does it go to further perpetuate these stereotypes?
The McLean's article notes that Asian students work harder is a fact borne out by hard data. They tend to be strivers, high achievers, and single-minded in their approach to university. But where is this hard data coming from?
How is this article going to go down in history, in Chinese Canadian, in telling the Chinese Canadian story?
I think just like the whole W5 campus giveaway controversy that happened 30 years ago, this is sad to say, but I would not be surprised if this happened in another 30 years.
This is part of the public outrage that followed a CTV telecast in the fall of 1979, a W5 item charging that Canadian universities are overcrowded with foreign students, particularly with Chinese students. The program was so insulting, its facts so distorted, and its assumptions so racist, that protests immediately came from ethnic groups, universities, and governments. Leading the protest was Toronto's Chinese community.
You're doing what every other minority group has had to do, whether it's Irish, or whether it's the Jews, or whether it was the Indians, or the blacks, or any other groups had to do. That is to face the fact that in this society, there's a great deal of bigotry.
In terms of W5, it keeps coming back up because of the similarities, and at this Youth Coalition meeting, we actually had two people who were involved with the W5, like strategic planning, who kind of talked to us about the similarities and the kind of tactics that they use in terms of mobilizing demonstrations all across Canada.
I would like to show you what happens when television journalism lapses into irresponsible journalism. On September 30th, 1979, the CTV program W5 aired an item called Campus Giveaway. This is how it began.
A scenario that would make a great many people in this country angry and resentful. Suppose your son or daughter wanted to be an engineer or a doctor or a pharmacist. Suppose he had high marks in high school and that you could pay the tuition, but he still couldn't get into university in his chosen course because a foreign student was taking his place. Well, that is exactly what is happening in this country, but hardly anyone wants to talk about it.
The McLean's article states, many white students simply believe that competing with Asians, both Asian Canadians and international students, requires a sacrifice of time and freedom they're not willing to make. They complain that they can't compete for spots in the best schools and can't party as hard as they'd like. Too bad for them, most will say. Asian kids, meanwhile, say they are resented for taking the spots of white kids.
What has made a great many people angry and resentful was the racism that ran through this whole W5 item. To begin with, international students are not taking places from Canadian students. This is clear in reports published by Statistics Canada, in studies done by Canadian universities, and in a comprehensive up-to-date report released by the Canadian Bureau for International Education. Yet with all this information available, W5 went on to say this.
It's not hard to understand why the public hasn't been given a chance to debate the foreign student problem. The statistics that show it is a problem aren't easy to find.
Interesting, because who are those people going overseas recruiting international students? I was in Hong Kong when I was applying for universities, and they recruit hard. And they know that international students will pay a lot, and If you're paying that much money to be here in this country, of course you're going to work hard because you're paying 3-4 times the amount the local students are paying. And you're away from home, and your parents are pretty much supporting you to basically come home with this piece of paper that's going to say, I can survive in this world. I mean, I'm not dying to be seen as Canadian, but the fact is we all are here, and we all have a right to be.
Do you think there are added boundaries now or barriers for Asians to get access to education?
I think the good thing is that it is getting people talking, but at the same time, it might be suggesting in people's minds, like, well, my son didn't get into U of T. Is it because of those Asians? That sense of entitlement. Who says that that spot is yours, you know? I think the danger in seeing all Asians as the model minority is that it ignores, first of all, the diversity of the community, and also, how about those who aren't high achievers? You know, there are students that drop out and who don't have the means to be able to go to the top universities or to even afford those universities. So you can go into a whole class analysis of this article and how it basically clumps all Asian Canadians into this sort of upper middle class who have the money to support their children and will do anything, like whatever it takes for them to survive.
Woke up and realized I was free to be anything. If it was an integrity with what I dreamed, I knew it couldn't be wrong and it would be done. I was born to be Earth's song.
Look around and I say touchdown.
By Erykah Badu off of her new album New America Part 2. This is CQT 90.3 Spitfire Radio, Women of Color Radio, every last Wednesday of the month at 6 p.m. Up next, we have an homage to Kimberly Crenshaw, critical race legal scholar.
Oh, hey, I just want a chance to fly, a chance to cry, and a long bye.
For colored girls who considered law school and not suicide. Or an homage to Kimberly Crenshaw. The greedy, status quo-maintaining, elitist, corporate-driven, and socially regressive nature of law school and the legal profession often deters many open-minded, spitfire minds of women of color who, because of who we are and what we believe in, feel that this world does not want us. Or that that world can never belong to us. I remember thinking that the law was interesting once, and then I remember thinking about all of the trust fund kids whose parents, both of whom were also lawyers, had planned for them to attend law school since they were rocked in the cradle, that cradle that cost more than most people's car. And then I remember thinking, hell to the no. Then I went to graduate school and realized that, in spite of its ideals, the academy, in many ways, can be just as regressive. Rich people torturing themselves with their own brilliance who are in the process of turning out the next radical and revolutionary treatise. Reading only dead white guys and sitting in rooms where professors looking down your shirt sneer at your insistence that Toni Morrison is as great a writer, if not better, than Chaucer. That bell hooks is in fact a theorist and an intellectual and not that angry black woman on TV or radio whose name escapes you. That black studies, women's studies, Asian American studies, Native American studies, Latino studies, and other studies of color are legitimate sites of scholarship. That one's real-world experience as a member of the Nazi Party, in the case of German well-cited philosopher Martin Heidegger, can never be divorced from their scholarship, however brilliant one alleges it may be. In my own transition into seeing the law as a possibility for myself, I have come to love a pioneer to the legal profession for all women of color, Kimberly Crenshaw. Professor Crenshaw is an African-American woman born in Ohio who graduated from Cornell University in 1981, majoring there in Africana Studies. From there, she attended Harvard Law, graduating with a JD in 84 and receiving a Master's of Law, which in the States is called an LLM, from the University of Wisconsin-Madison in 1985. Since then, she has been a part of the UCLA Faculty of Law since 1986, and demanding that black women and women of color and all of us who fit between the cracks of the law have a voice and have laws that protect and ensure our well-being and flourishing. In 1988, Crenshaw's foundational article, Race, Reform, and Retrenchment, Transformation and Legitimation in Anti-Discrimination Law, predicted and argued against the, quote, colorblind approach to addressing racial disparities in the law, now known popularly as post-racialism, or the idea that ignoring racial differences is the lone and most effective way to eliminate racism in our society. This article was groundbreaking and paved the way for her frequently cited 1991 article entitled Mapping the Margins, Intersectionality, Identity Politics, and Violence Against Women of Color. This article uses case law, police archival information, and anecdotal examples from women of color's own experiences trying to access women's shelters, predominantly run by white women, to show how identity politics within both communities of color and white women's dominated spaces often works to the detriment of women of color. In the case of black women in black communities, for instance, Crenshaw shows that, despite the popular conception that black men are disproportionately punished by the criminal justice system for the crime of rape, in fact, When the survivor is a black woman instead of a white woman, they actually experience far less punishment. The same is true for other domestic violence charges black men potentially face when the woman is black. They all lead to more lenient results. Mapping the Margins and Crenshaw's other legal articles have made her a prominent and pioneering legal figure in the field of critical race studies, which is a branch off of the field of critical legal studies. And Crenshaw is the founding coordinator of the Critical Race Theory Workshop. In a book which she co-edited entitled Critical Race Theory, The Key Writings That Form the Movement, published in 1995, critical race theory's primary goals are described as understanding how a regime of white supremacy and its subordination of people of color has been created and maintained, and secondly, to examine the relationship between the social structure erected by white supremacy in relation to professed ideals such as the rule of law and equal protection. Crenshaw's influence has had international and generational reach, making her one of the most important legal minds out there. Today, she is often featured as a commentator on various aspects of law and racial politics, and her scholarly interests continue to center around race and the law. Talk about putting the academy to good use. Her work on race and gender, for instance, was influential in the drafting of the Equality Clause in the post-apartheid South African Constitution. In 2001, she wrote the background paper on race and gender discrimination for the United Nations World Conference on Racism, and helped to facilitate the addition of gender in the conference's declaration. Crenshaw is also a member of the National Science Foundation's Committee to Research Violence Against Women. In the early 1990s, during the testimony of Anita Hill during Clarence Thomas's confirmation hearings, Crenshaw served as a member of Anita Hill's legal team, offering her professional and emotional support. Today, Crenshaw splits her time to teach at UCLA and Columbia Law School, teaching civil rights and other courses in critical race studies and constitutional law. She has twice been elected Professor of the Year and has received numerous awards and honorary degrees, a tribute to the merits of her work, its reach, and its impact on people's lives. Importantly, Crenshaw is also co-founder of the African American Policy Forum. Founded in 1996, the forum's mission is dedicated to advancing and expanding racial justice, gender equality, and the indivisibility of all human rights, both in the U.S. and internationally. This is not just the work of an amazingly accomplished woman. This is testament to the notion that radically oriented women of color can and are making an impact in the legal profession, a profession and institution of law which have both never been on our side when it comes to justice. Crenshaw has been influential to shaping our understandings of gender-based violence women of color face, in addition to being a fierce advocate for stronger sexual harassment HR policies. And we know that sexual harassment is almost an issue of certainty for women of color in school or at the workplace. So, women of color convinced law school is not for you? The elitism, seeming regressiveness, conservatism, and all-around ridiculousness of it aside, there can and is a place for you and your ideas in, quite frankly, what is a very influential institution in our society. The next time the topic of law comes up, then, don't forget there is a powerful voice and tradition in there for you, for your life, and for your experience. What is needed now is for a new generation to carry Crenshaw's message and work forward.
On Thursday, November 25th, trip into the Sala Rosa as Pharmacon MTL launches their stellar new CD, To Call Out in the Night, with special guest Sam Shalabi and performances by dancers, projection artists, and more. This night is beauty in motion and a journey you won't forget. Featuring Ian Ferrier, Mo Clark, Valerie Kayat, and Pharmacon at the Sala, 4848 Saint-Laurent, Thursday, November 25th, 9 p.m. $7 gets you in, an extra $3 gets the new CD, and it is beautiful. To Call Out in the Night is a CKUT co-presentation.
Thank you so much to everyone who pledged to CKUT's 20- 2010 funding drive, Horn of Plenty. Your donations keep us going. So now that you've donated, how do you pay? We accept cash, check, money order, and credit card. Mail donations to 3647 University, Montreal, Quebec, H3A2B3. Pay by credit card on the web at ckut.ca. Come by the station in person to pay your pledge, pick up your gifts, and see where your generous donation is going. We are open Monday to Friday, noon till 7 p.m. If you missed the funding drive but still want to donate, call 514-907-9424. You may do so before December 15th to be eligible for the grand prize draw. Thanks again for making this year's funding drive a smashing success.
This is Michelle Mendege Ocello, and you're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. Keep it locked. Daddy's sweet on the bar, just a little too sweet. And every night the man should...
Turn me up. I want to hear the music.
Yeah.
I want to feel that vibe.
Turn it up.
Are we on the air?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, we're here.
All over the world, man. Gotta make that money, man. Make your money, y'all. Do what you got to do.
Hey, that does it for another edition of Spitfire Radio. Thanks for tuning in. Spitfire Radio, Women of Color Radio, every last Wednesday of the month at 6 p.m. We also have one event to announce. This is for METRAC, the Metropolitan Action Committee on Violence Against Women and Children, METRAC. It's an important nonprofit organization that strives to end violence against women and children in Toronto. They have a fundraising event this Saturday on November 27th, and their goal is to raise $20,000 for their REACT initiative, which is METRAC's Peer Youth Violence Prevention Program. So even donating just a little will help, and Chris Smith Management, the team behind artists Nelly Furtado and Pippi Dobson, have also donated to this cause. So, and also donating enters your name into a draw to win an autographed prize from the management team. So if you want to donate, please visit www.metrac.org. That's METRAC.org. And yeah, so that does it for our show this month. And so tune in again next month in December for our last show of the year. Oh, and if you want to write to us, if you have any comments, you can always email us at spitfire@skut.ca, S-P-I-T-F-I-Y-A-H @skut.ca, or even you can also go onto our blog where we store our archives, www.spitfire.blogspot.com. So have a good month.